Time to take a look at home renovation and repair issues here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller with two guests joining us today. Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison. It's a full-service residential remodeling company. They specialize in sustainable design and historic renovation, and you can find more about them at chadscarpentry.com. Chad Spade, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
Also with us today, Dave Kenyon, a project manager of the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation in Madison. It's his first visit with us. He works with single-family homes and involved with the Wisconsin Energy Star Home Program, so thought it'd be a great idea to have him in today. John Viner's off on vacation somewhere. So Dave Kenyon, thanks very much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Larry.
Tell us about the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation.
Yeah, the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation has been around for 30-odd years.
Yeah.
And doing energy programming for all that time. In particular, they are the administrator of the Focus on Energy programs, the statewide energy programs, and actually Wisconsin Energy Star Homes falls under that Focus on Energy. So while I'm employed by Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation, I'm actually working for Focus on Energy.
Okay.
Figure that one out.
And you get to work with single-family homes quite a bit.
Yes, primarily new construction, although my newest project is working in affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
Working with housing authorities and Habitat for Humanities and putting together some programming for that sector of the market.
Perfect. Well, Chad, I imagine you're a busy guy right now.
It's a busy time. Yes, it is.
Busy time of the year. We had an email from Tyler who this summer is planning to remove the vinyl siding of his 100-year-old home. And underneath is the original clapboard siding. And he wonders about, he'd like to refinish those clapboards there's peeling paint cracking and all that underneath. Can that be done?
Well, it's possible. The biggest hazard that he's going to face is that it's very likely lead paint has been applied to those siding boards. And so removal of the lead is dangerous, and it has to be done properly. So there's a lot to learn. He should take in a sample and have it tested and find out exactly what he's dealing with. And then there are a number of strategies that could be used. I have a friend who recently salvaged all of the cedar siding off of his home, flipped it around, finished the backside, which had never been finished, and has created a beautiful remodeled exterior reusing the existing boards with minimal contact or interaction with those layers of lead paint, which in effect have now become the backside of the board. And you do want to, whenever you install or reinstall any sort of wood siding, it's very important that the backside be sealed up of the wood itself. So
there's ways it could be done then.
Yeah.
All right.
Good luck.
Let's go to David in Madison. David, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Well, I've got a siding question also. We're going to be starting a remodel on a 1930s Cape Cod, and as part of the remodel, we want to get rid of our ugly vinyl siding, and the wood siding underneath is pretty bad. So we were thinking of fiber cement, and I was talking to a friend, and he mentioned something about LP Smart Side. I tried to do some research, but I haven't been able to find out a whole lot about it other than it's an OSB-based product. And I was wondering if you had any ideas, pros and cons on fiber cement versus the LP Smart Side.
Well, the fiber cement board is an excellent product. There are a couple of different brands out there. There are some issues with the product. Like all products, they have their pros and cons. But fiber cement is a good long-term product. If properly handled and installed, it should give you 50 to 100 years of performance. Oftentimes, it has a 50-year warranty on the product, and the paint finish will have anywhere from a 25 to 50-year warranty. When you're dealing with an OSB product, you're dealing with wood fiber.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been, over the years, a number of wood fiber siding boards, and they have had a limited to, I think, largely poor track records,
okay, or,
you know, limited success. And so I tend to stay away from those products, but it is possible. I have heard about this product. I know it's a green certified product, but the caveat there is that it's using a lot of otherwise scrap material. Mm-hmm. But if something doesn't last very long, I don't think that's green.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to make compost in the yard, but I don't think we want to be making compost on the side of our homes. And some of these products rot almost immediately. So I have a little bit of hesitation there. But having said that, I know a number of people out there that are big advocates for this particular product. So I think the jury's still out.
Yeah, see, that's the issue with me is sort of I'd like to see something that's been around for more than 3 or 4 years because I've.
Yeah.
I still remember their original class action lawsuits against LP for their original hardboard siding. And
right.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we had Dave. You want to make a comment while we're at it?
I was going to say cost issues come into this sometimes too.
And, you know, they're actually right about the same price.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, we put fiber cement siding on our home. We added an additional layer of insulation, then put this fiber cement siding on. You need to have somebody, as I think Chad was intimating there, you need to have somebody who knows how to install it properly because it's different. It's a different kind of – it's not vinyl.
Yeah.
It's great stuff. I mean, we love the look, and the paint is – you know, it's been on 4 years, but, yeah, it looks like it was yesterday painted.
Right. Okay. You're basically confirming what I was already leaning toward, so I appreciate the extra information. Thank you very much.
All right. Mm-hmm.
If I can just add one other thing, and that is that new or old houses, you know, all siding leaks.
Yeah.
And so it's very important to get a good moisture barrier up there again, underneath the siding.
Yep, absolutely. Well, we have more callers online. You can join in, by the way, as well at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Dave, I know there are tax credits out there for those people who want to make their homes more energy efficient. That's something that comes up a lot on the program. Maybe you could say a few words about that.
There's a lot of tax credits out there, and I don't know all of them, but I would encourage you to go to the EnergyStar.gov website. They have a particular page dedicated to the federal tax credits for energy efficiency, and they also have a dedicated page for the renewable energy. So basically the EnergyStar.gov website is the place to go. And you don't have to pay to get onto the website.
Yeah, and there's a lot of great information on that website. A lot. And it's easy to use, too. The site itself is easy to use.
And there's a lot of frequently asked questions that are answered there.
FAQs,
so it's a good website.
Mm-hmm.
And, Larry, I would just add as a point of summary that if for people, listeners that don't know, there's about $1,500 in tax credits available for a number of energy efficiency-related projects. And, of course, they'll learn about that on the site. It's important for consumers to realize that the tax credits cover 30% of the material cost. Mm-hmm. So when you're buying qualifying windows, doors, air sealing products, insulation products, basically you can spend $5,000.
Yeah.
And then 30% of that would be the $1,500 that you then could get as a credit. So that's a big opportunity that is that's out there right now.
On top of that, I think it's also important to say that through Focus on Energy, they aren't tax credits, but there is incentives available that you can put towards the project.
Yeah, absolutely. And we did when we were doing some of our work. We took advantage of it and saved ourselves several $100s, actually. Jake in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Jake. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a new home buyer.
Okay.
My wife and I just bought our first home. And it's got vinyl siding. And not immediately, but in the next couple of years, we're looking into replacing it. And we're wondering two things. First, can you recycle vinyl siding? And then the second thing is, what are some green options for siding other than maybe the ones you've already talked about? And I'll take your answer off the line.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, good questions. I mean, there are people out there that will take that siding and do something with it. You can shred up a vinyl siding, and it can be reconstituted into various other vinyl products. There's some decking products out there that are using reclaimed vinyl. It's a little tricky because when a company manufactures a product and they put a warranty on it, they have to be very careful what they're putting into it. You know, when you have a product that's supposed to last 25 or 50 years, you need to have some quality control on the materials that are going into it. So I'm a little skeptical sometime about the claims on recycling vinyl. I would say generally that vinyl is a good thing only from the extent that it never goes away. But from an environmental perspective, that makes it a really challenging material. Vinyl is final. It never goes away. It won't necessarily last forever doing whatever you've installed it to do. But then once it starts to break apart or denigrate, it's pretty much, if it can't get reclaimed in some way, it's going to end up in a landfill, and you know, people 1,000 years from now will be finding that stuff and wondering what we were thinking. So I would say for green products, my criteria is that it be able to last a long time. You know, the classic green exterior is a stone or masonry wall. You know, it can be a 100-year or 500-year wall. Unfortunately, it's terribly expensive to make. But in many respects, that's the greenest way to go, is a properly designed and installed masonry wall. There are a number of products we've discussed. You know, certainly a properly applied wood paneled wall can be very sustainable if the wood is relatively locally harvested and has been properly installed and treated. It can last well over 100 years. You know, typically the sorts of things you're looking at for green criteria, because there's no absolute answer, does it last a long time? Is the material, you know, reusable, and is it renewable? Is it something that can be fairly locally acquired? I mean, these are all criteria. As Dave pointed out earlier, obviously cost is a criteria. Unfortunately, the reason we see so much vinyl is it's really cheap, and we don't bear the environmental cost as a society. We don't do anything to tax the producer to help to offset the negative environmental impact that producing and then essentially, you know, having to do away with that once it's depleted. No one's paying for that, really. We, as a whole society, we're paying for it in cleanup costs, but the person who's purchasing the product is not directly paying for that.
Yeah. Let's take some more calls. Christian in Green Bay, we're on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. I'm going to be finishing my basement this summer, and I got a question about framing up the exterior walls. Two questions, actually. What is the best way to insulate that wall? And then also, I have asbestos tile on my floor from a previous remodel done in the 60s. And what is the best way to attach the toe board for my wall, or the baseboard for my wall, onto that flooring? Is it to nail through or to glue? I'm not sure what direction to go there.
The tile is on a cement floor?
Correct. It's the tile is attached directly to the cement, and we know it's asbestos because when we bought the house, we found boxes of tile labeled asbestos tile.
Okay. Truth in advertising.
Yeah,
exactly. It was easy.
Well, you know, the one thing that I'll say about asbestos is that asbestos doesn't present any problems so long as you don't disturb it. So I would not encourage you to be driving nails through it. Typically, you would install a baseboard or a shoe trim by tacking it to the wall itself. And so then it's simply on the floor but being nailed to the wall material.
Okay.
So that would probably be the best way to do that. And I wouldn't recommend gluing it down to the floor, because if there is any water that is in that wall, you want it to be able to get out, and you want to see it and be able to deal with it. To answer the question about insulation, I'm going to try to give a brief answer, and then Dave might be able to add something. You definitely want to use an insulation material that will not be depleted by high moisture, because you're going up against a foundation wall, and it's likely, given the age of the home, that there's not good water proofing on the exterior of the foundation. So moisture is going to be coming through that. One very effective way to go is simply to put up a styrofoam blue board insulation and caulk or tape the seams, and then you would have to frame the wall and install some sort of material that would provide fireproofing. What we often do is frame the wall in a way that it's an inch or two away from the wall, and there's uninterrupted space there. And then we have a closed-cell foam sprayed onto the wall. And that's going to provide you with good air sealing and insulation. Generally, it's best if you can get 2 inches of foam product, which would give you approximately an R10. That's what the recommendation right now, below grade. And the last thing I'll say is that there should be no vapor barrier installed down below grade. If there is any moisture in that wall, and there likely will be, you want it to be able to pass through the wall into your structure and not be trapped back there where it will feed on anything that it can feed on and, of course, cause mold and other problems, rotting.
Dave, anything to add to that?
Yeah, a couple things. One thing not to do is if you frame up the wall, the historically what people have done is put fiberglass in there, and fiberglass below grade is not recommended because of moisture.
Yeah.
So what you're going to try and do there is, first of all, make sure that as little water as possible gets through that wall by making sure all your grading's right and everything on the outside. And then I agree with Chad very much that if you can get R5, R10 on that wall in terms of blue board or pink board or whatever kind of board, and then frame up your wall. The one additional thing I would say is that at the ceiling level, where that wall hits the floor joists, you want to air seal across to your rim board, because otherwise what happens is that that warm, moist air can go up into the floor joists, over your wall, and down the backside. And so you run a small risk of some condensation with that warm, moist air getting to a colder surface.
Good points. Thanks again for that call, Christian. Appreciate it very much. Talking home renovation, repair, energy issues today with Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, and with Dave Kenyon, project manager of the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in with a home renovation or repair or energy efficiency question, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. An open line or two, we'll get you on pretty quickly here. Let's go to Peter in Monona next. Hi, Peter. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Enjoying your program.
Thanks.
My question has to do with spray foam insulation, and specifically in the attic. I've read information that says past 6 inches, even though that's only an R21-22, that you don't gain much by adding more spray foam. So I'd like your guests to comment on that, if they would, please.
All right.
Okay. Well, typically, it's an excellent question. Typically with spray foam, you're looking at R values of anywhere from 5 to 8 R per inch. And so 6 inches would actually translate into an R30 to an R40 plus. And there is quite a bit of research that shows after you apply 4 to 5 inches of spray foam, you get rapidly diminishing returns on, continued resistance to heat flow. The trick is, of course, getting the code officials to buy into that reduced R value, because on the one hand, you're looking at R value, which is the resistance to heat across that that wall or ceiling assembly, But then because you have something that's continuously applied, because it's a spray product that fills up the space and theoretically has no air leaks, it actually ends up performing at a far greater efficiency or a higher level than your old-fashioned kind of fiberglass bat assembly. So that's part of what's going on in the science of insulation and why it is possible to have an assembly with less R-value but higher performance. I'm sure Dave...
Dave, got something to add to that? Yeah.
I from the perspective of builders, I guess, is where I would come from, and that is that spray... And it comes down to cost, but I think there's also some green issues in here. Definitely spray foam the junctions in the attic. In other words, where walls come through to meet trusses.
Okay.
Those are all air leakage points. So a lot of times what we would advocate is use your materials wisely. Do an air seal package in the attic using foam. You take care of all the many little holes that are occurring there. And then come back with some kind of material, whether it's fiberglass, cellulose, or spray foam. Effective R value, I guess I really can't speak to that very well beyond what the manufacturer is talking about and best practices in terms of installation.
Yeah. All right. All right. Thanks again for calling, Peter. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Willie, thanks a lot. Willie in Door County emailed us and wants to know the recommendation or the recommended time to cure a fresh concrete slab prior to building a structure on top. And, you know, I watched this, Extreme Makeover Home Edition on Sunday nights. It's one of my wife's favorite shows. And, I mean, they pour those – they're pouring that slab and putting that house up all in a week, and you wonder sometimes.
It boggles the mind. It's an excellent question. Generally, our recommendation, both from our subcontractors and just our knowledge of best practice, would be you always want to leave the slab for a week, and you certainly don't build on a foundation any faster than a week. So how those homes that Extreme Home Makeover puts up, how they hold up is probably a good question. So that would
a week,
be
you're
our
saying
answer.
A week it'd be
you want to wait a week in between pouring
minimum
and, yeah
that'd be
you know, if you can allow it to cure longer, that's great.
Yeah, because you lose strength if you start. Let's put it this way. Concrete strengthens through time, and if you can afford to leave it 10 days, 2 weeks, especially on slabs, that's an important for durability.
Yeah, I've often wondered about that when I'm watching the show on Sunday evenings. Well, there's a rural mail carrier who emailed and wants to put a ceramic tile over linoleum tile containing the linoleum contains asbestos. What does she have to do?
Well, you know, that's a tricky thing. It is possible to go over a product, and generally what we recommend, if there's space for it, is to put down a new quarter-inch substrate of some sort. You can put down a Hardiebacker cement board, which is designed as an underlayment for ceramic tile, and then you accomplish two things by putting this down. You create a new a uniform surface that's clean, and you know you're going to get good adhesion between the mastic for the new tile and that new subfloor. And then you also completely encapsulate that asbestos tile that's beneath it. The downside, of course, is that you're going to be adding more than a half inch of floor material.
Yeah.
Maybe that's going to create some problems, large thresholds and steps coming into the room. But that's a great way to avoid disturbing that old asbestos tile. The other option, of course, is to have a professional asbestos remediation contractor come in and professionally and responsibly remove that material. And then you could install tile down at a level closer to the original.
Yeah. Not something you want to do yourself, though.
No, not the asbestos removal.
No. Tim in New Berlin, it's your turn now. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Yes, my question is, if you're going to add some rock around the perimeter of your house to improve the grade to get moisture to run away, and this would be rock on top of rock, some people have advised taking like pond liner and going a foot below the top of the rock and having pond liner there to assist in having the moisture run away from your house. What is your feeling on that?
So you already have some rock around the house. You want to put additional rock, so you're talking maybe putting pond liner over the top of the rocks that you now have and then putting new rocks on top of that.
Yeah, some people have told me that's the thing to do, and I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Well, you know, I think I know what you're getting at, because there are a variety of issues here. If you have rock up against a house, and that's mostly what you have, I mean, many times when we backfill around an addition or a new foundation, there will be rock that comes up almost to grade, and it's very consciously put there to allow for good drainage down to a drain tile on the perimeter of the foundation. But actually, at the very top, you want to discourage water from getting into that system. The rock is there to allow it to easily flow to the tile and be pumped out if it gets there. But chances are, maybe you don't even have that sort of a system. You just want to keep the water away from the house. So if you only have rock, that's very porous, and the water is going to continue to be along the foundation, and you're not going to be getting it away from the house. Generally, you need a good clay cap or something like that that would discourage most of the water from percolating into the soil and will actually flow away from the home before it then is absorbed, ideally, into the landscape, you know, a number of feet out beyond the foundation. You know, it's a little dangerous to be putting liners and things down into the ground, because you may be trapping water or causing pooling and creating other problems. But if you do have a good grade and there's material there that will actually make the water flow away from the foundation before it percolates into the soil, that's the goal. And there are a variety of materials that can be used to achieve it.
Yeah,
I would ask, do you have a basement or your slab on grade?
Yeah, no, we have a basement.
You have a basement. Yeah, I would agree with Chad that that surface water, you want to get away from the house as fast as you can. So you want some kind of clay layer there fairly close to the surface, maybe just underneath some black soil or something. But you want to get that surface water away as fast as you can get it away.
All right.
So you think the pond liner is a good idea or a bad idea?
I would probably opt for some kind of clay or denser soil,
okay,
if you've got room for it there.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe you might say dig up the rock, put in solid dirt, and then put maybe the rock back on top or something like that?
You know, in fact, at my house, I've done that on one part of the house where I don't particularly like gutters on the front part of the house. Mm-hmm. So I need to make sure that the water falling doesn't dig holes.
Okay.
So what I've done is I do have sort of a clay area, but then I put rock on top of it so I don't get washing away of that soil.
Oh.
So that's one good way to look at the usage of rock.
Okay.
I see. Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Here's an email from Bonnie in Mount Horeb. Can you please tell me, if you know, where I can get a stain chip tested to see if the provider put on inside stain on my outside door? So she's apparently the stain is not held up, and she thinks it was an inside stain.
Well, that's...
Do you know the manufacturer, or just you got a chip paint? Paint chip, I mean.
Yeah,
it's really a stain chip. I don't know how.
Yeah,
you...
stain chip.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, it would be the varnish that would be the problem. I mean, typically the stain is going to you know, be something that you, is applied to create a color, and then you want an exterior grade varnish of some sort on the door.
So it's probably the varnish. So you'd have to know probably the name of the varnish.
Yeah, and I mean, I think her problem is probably she doesn't have that. Yeah. Someone installed it. They didn't provide anything, any sort of product. Or if they did, she's trying to figure out if that's, in fact, what they installed on it. And that's a tough one. You know, there might be someone at the UW or UW Extension that could help with that. But I have to say that I have no direct knowledge of someone that can do that at a reasonable cost.
I wonder if Forest Products Lab?
Well, it's possible.
Forest Products Lab might do that.
You know, they've tested so many things,
yeah,
and it's ongoing testing of products and how they look. You know, they might have people there on staff that simply could look at it and give you a pretty good educated opinion of what it is that was done or not done to your door. So, good luck.
Yeah. So Forest Products Laboratory is located right in Madison. So go online to their website and find out whether or not they can help you. Lisa in Wausau, it's up to you now. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was just calling to see if you have any suggestions in regards to vinyl siding that I'm not ready to put into the landfill yet. But this house faces directly west, so that side of the house, the siding seems to be oxidized. I've pressure washed with vinyl siding wash, and that doesn't seem to help. And I wondered if you had any suggestions. It's like powdery.
How old is the siding that you have? Do you know?
I think it's 14 years old. We moved in last year.
Okay. All right, Chad, what do you think?
I wish I knew a really good thing to be done with it. I mean, that is one of the classic problems with vinyl products, is that they can break down from UV damage, sun exposure, and heat. There are some darker vinyl sidings out there which have literally melted on the sides of homes because they absorb so much heat that they can't handle it, and it's plastic and it will melt. And so
there are some, well, I don't know if you're interested in this, but I've heard or seen recently that there are some paints now that can be applied to some vinyl, and I'm wondering what you think about that idea.
Well, you know, I guess it wouldn't hurt to try it. Given that you already have the vinyl siding and there are obvious problems with the west side. I mean, one thing that I'll throw out there, which is clearly not a short-term solution, but I don't know if you have any shading of the west side, but, you know, just from a total kind of energy and siting perspective, it's good generally to have some shade trees to the south and west, and that will help long-term with any siding that you have to keep the house cool, to help the exterior weather better and reduce its UV damage and heat-related issues. I think maybe trying the paint is a worthwhile short-term solution. I have very little experience with the vinyl paints. I think we actually tried that once for a client. I don't remember getting any feedback, good or bad.
Probably why there's so many beige houses. That would make sense.
Right. Well, there is a reason why vinyl tends to be lighter colors. And,
right,
you know,
I think one thing you might do is if you happen to know a manufacturer, go to the manufacturer's website or a retailer in the neighborhood and see what they recommend.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see. Let's go to, well, Beth in Dodge County emailed us. I think Beth's the next in line here. Wonders what's a ballpark price for a geothermal heat pump. Dave, you got any idea?
There's quite a range for geothermal costs, install costs, probably starting at $13,000-$14,000 and going upwards. There's a lot of site-specific costs. I guess if you need anything beyond that kind of really rough estimate, you should probably contact, there are usually plumbing installers within your neighborhood, and just go and ask them, and I'm sure they'd be more than happy to focus you in on a little bit less of a price range than I can give you.
Okay.
Yeah, and Dave, does Focus on Energy have some recommended HVAC installers for geothermal systems? I was thinking they did, but I'm not positive.
No.
Do you know? Okay. All right.
All right, but probably a minimum $13,000.
Yeah.
And up. Eric in Wisconsin Rapids, it's your turn now. Hi, Eric.
Hi, I have a question on geothermal heat pumps, too. I was looking at, I have about a 3,600-square-foot Victorian home that I'm currently heating with forced air.
Okay.
And it's got old wooden windows, and I was just wondering what would be a better investment, because I have about 45 to 50 windows I would have to replace, and they're all, you know, the 5 foot by 6 foot, or, you know, 5 foot by three foot wide. So I'm looking at an investment in windows, and what would be a better investment, putting in a heat pump or the windows?
Sounds like you got some pretty good views around there.
Yeah, we do. Windows, that's for sure.
If you can't contain your heat with your house, and basically I'm talking energy efficiency needs to come first. If you can't contain the heat, it doesn't matter what system you're using for producing that heat. You're going to be wasting a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
My recommendation would be that you have your house tested by a Home Performance with Energy Star consultant first, and they can get you some kind of roadmap as to you know, how to proceed, how best to, where to put your money.
Yeah, and that's a great idea. It costs you maybe a couple hundred dollars to have that done. That's basically what they charge, and somewhere between $200 and $300, and you get. At least we, when we did that for our home, we got back money from the power company.
Uh-huh.
Provided us a...
Once certain improvements are made, that's correct.
Yeah.
I would just add to that, I would agree completely with getting the home performance evaluation, and I would add that you're likely to find that the biggest payback that of all the things that might be recommended would be to improve the air sealing and insulation envelope of the home. And sometimes that's complicated on an old Victorian, and it might cost a little more than it would otherwise cost in homes that are built differently, but it's still going to be considerably less expense than replacing windows and probably less than replacing the heating system for a home of that size. So that, I would agree with Dave, but the reason you want to have the home performance evaluation is that you're actually going to have scientific data and an unbiased evaluator who is sharing expertise with you about your particular home and the ways that it can be improved. And that's invaluable because most of us are trying to sell you something. And, you know, I can tell you I've talked people out of replacing their windows because I know they're looking to save energy and make a good long-term investment. And windows tend to have about a 30 to 40-year payback. Now, having said that, there are a lot of great reasons to upgrade your windows that are different than energy efficiency payback. You know, your house will be quieter, it'll be more comfortable, they'll be easier to clean. These are all intangible things that have great value to most of us, but they're not going to pay back their investment costs quickly in your reduced heating bills. So,
I would just add one other thing, and that is that part of this home performance deal is that you know, a lot of numbers are crunched, and the consultant can put some kind of number on, you know, what kind of payback in terms of the geothermal and its good performance versus air sealing and insulating a house and its performance, so that you're in a much better position to look at that payback.
So if you go to focusonenergy.com, you're going to find a list of people in your area who are certified and able to do that home performance evaluation. And I would certainly be, that would be where I'd go to find somebody in your and certainly in the Wisconsin Rapids area. I know there are people there. So
yep.
There you have it. Good luck, Eric. Thanks a lot for calling. Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, one of our guests. The other, Dave Kenyon, project manager of the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation, with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Radio wakes you in the mornings. It rides along on your daily commute. Radio informs, entertains, delights. NPR is radio. Radio that takes you there.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Physicians Plus Insurance Corporation, owned by Meritor Health Services and local doctors, partnering with families and businesses to make wellness an everyday part of life. Online at healthychoicesbigrewards.com.
Talking home renovation, repair issues, energy efficiency with our two guests today, Chad Spate of Chad's Carpentry in Madison. It's a full-service residential remodeling company, and they specialize in sustainable design and historic renovations. Take a look at their website at chadscarpentry.com. Dave Kenyon, project manager of the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation in Madison, works with single-family homes and with the Wisconsin Energy Star Home Program. So happy to have them with us. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And an email from Gretchen in Oshkosh. She says, I currently have brick on the facade of my house on two exterior walls built in 1984. The brick is ugly. I'd like to replace it with stone or stone veneer. Is that possible? Easy? Expensive? Those are the three. Is it possible? If it is it easy or is it expensive?
Yeah, the devil's always in the details. I mean, the only way to really find out is to have a qualified professional, a mason, come out and have a look at the house. There occasionally are circumstances where a veneer can be applied over an existing masonry surface, but that's a tricky undertaking, and you obviously want whatever you do to last, and so it's really going to depend on what professional determines.
So you need somebody out there to take a look at it. Let's go to Sybil in Genesee. Hi, Sybil.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I am renovating my home, obviously. I have a drive-under garage with a living room on top. The garage was built a little overkill. It is about 15, 16 feet high, about 28 feet long, and about 38 feet wide.
I wish I had a garage like that.
it's the man took his cars very seriously, obviously. Yeah, there are two dry wells, which I understand are no longer code. I'm assuming I would have to close those off. I want to turn this into a living space. And I'm getting a lot of input on what I can and cannot do. I obviously need to raise the floor and seal it, put down foam insulation. It is completely drywalled on the walls. And I'm wondering how tall can I go? How do I keep the moisture from coming up through the concrete? And so on.
Wow.
I've gotten at least four different opinions on what to do.
And you're converting this garage with a 16-foot-high ceiling, did I hear you say?
Correct.
Okay. You're converting that to living space.
Correct.
Okay. Well, one nice thing is that you can create a code-compliant and also, partially conditioned crawl space within that structure. So, it used to be in the old days that crawl spaces were thought of as ventilated spaces that were connected to the outdoors. And we've learned over the years that that's not good building practice. But if you have a crawl space that's accessible from within and is part of the envelope of the home, similar to a typical basement, that will create a warmer, more comfortable floor. It will allow you to run whatever mechanical systems you need to run up above the old cement floor. It will allow you to completely insulate on top of that cement, and put down a vapor barrier on top of the cement. I mean, you know, had the cement been put in originally, or if you were putting in new cement now, you would want a vapor barrier below it. But I think that you'd probably want to have Visqueen and a good, I'd go for, you know, at least R10, maybe more on top of it, and then leave a few feet for access, and then frame a floor. And there
it does sweat. The basement floor does sweat. It is impeccable. It was built in 75. It is impeccably built. I mean, there's no cracks whatsoever in the mm-hmm. concrete, and both sides.
Right.
So I'm just, I guess I can run my plumbing then under the floor.
Correct.
And, of course, I don't have to do the fire code, I'm assuming, anymore in transit from the garage to the other living room, because it's no longer a garage. Am I correct?
Correct. I mean, once you make that living space where you're not parking vehicles, that, you know, you have changed the function of that space.
Or keeping your lawnmowers or
other flammable.
No, that's what I put out in the shed.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. And the walls, as far as it is a concrete block set wall, it does have 2x6 studs right now, and it does have a foam insulation in it, and then, of course, the drywall. And I'm wondering if I should build, for insulation, R-value, another wall on top of that, or if that's overkill. Because the insulation they use is, of course, not the best, and some of it shrunk or wasn't placed real tight.
So for your wall assembly, you're talking you have a a framed wall inside of a concrete block wall? Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay. Well, that
they put a vapor barrier up against the concrete block, and then they have the wall.
Yeah.
They sort of did it differently.
Yeah. If you're going to go to the expense of making this a living space, you want to cut through that vapor retarder that they've got between the wall, the framed wall, and the concrete wall, because that vapor retarder needs to be to the warm side of the wall.
That's what I, yeah.
So you're going to have to slash the one on the outside. You're probably not going to be able to pull it out, so you just slash it so it doesn't act as a vapor retarder. And then you can do your insulating in the framed wall, and then you bring in a new vapor retarder right underneath your new drywall.
But is it below grade?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I'm sorry.
It's an exposed basement. I apologize. I didn't mention that.
Okay, yeah. So you don't, if it is below grade, you're not going to want to put in that vapor retarder that I was mentioning.
Oh. Okay, got it. Okay.
All right.
Well, and good I can luck. Come up plenty with the floors because of the crawl space. I'm not limited.
I was going to ask the
question. 16 feet, I can come up quite a bit.
How do you get access into the main house? That's the question I was going to have. If you bring the floor up in the garage, are you still going to be accessing the rest of the lower level?
Yes, I'm going to take out both garage doors. It is a landing stone exterior. I'll be laying concrete block and then, of course, putting the landing stone to match. It's not hard to match. And I can come up as far as I want as long as I have a stair going up into the patio doors.
Okay.
So
okay.
I don't foresee that being a problem.
No.
I can come up quite a bit before I run into any, you know, steep problems.
Sounds like
so
a plan.
Yep.
Pardon?
I say it sounds like a plan to me.
Yes, that's quite a project, but at least I don't have to listen to the grinding noise of my garage doors.
All right. Well, you know, a little oil, those garage doors. So at least it works on my garage doors. Oh, boy. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's see. We have Jeff emailed, and there was a question earlier about chalking on some siding, and he says that there's a product called Penetrol by Flood, and it works on chalking. He says you apply it, you wipe it, and you dry it, and that takes the chalking out. I don't know if you guys have ever had any experience with it, but it's probably worth a try. It's called Penetrol by Flood. And speaking of Flood, Randy in Waukesha has a flooding problem. Yes, Randy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I live on the bottom of a big hill. I have bedrock about a foot and a half below the basement. I pump a lot of water. I have 5 2-inch commercial sump pumps. Many times all 5 are running. We've conceded to the water. We're going to fill in the basement with 3 feet of stone, vapor barrier, and a new slab. How much do I need to break up the basement floor before we do this?
Where the water is collecting in a sump system right now, it's not flowing through the walls, is it?
Or no, it's coming through the sump pump crocks. I have 2 3-foot by 3-foot crocks.
Okay.
And we're just sick of the pumping, pumps failing, power goes out, the basement floods. Yeah. We're going to fill it in.
All right, well, I tell you what, we're going to do some pondering on that and think about that a little bit. For a couple of minutes here, because we've got news coming up next. Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry, Dave Kenyon of the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at home renovation and repair issues today with our two guests, Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison. It's a full-service residential remodeling company, and they have a website, chadscarpentry.com. Dave Kenyon, project manager of the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation, and he also works with the Wisconsin Energy Star Home Program. They have a website as well. It's weccusa.org. for Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation. So weccusa.org. Pleased to have them along. Larry Mueller here. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Randy in Waukesha has an issue. He's got a basement where he's got pumps going, 2 pumps, and he's sick to death of the constant pumping because of the water coming up from underneath, and he is now ready to throw in the towel and sort of break up the basement floor and put some rock or something in there. How do you react to this? Chad, I'll start with you.
Yeah, well, we were talking about it during the break. We're a little bit concerned because, you know, if there are groundwater issues that are causing this flooding where you've got, you know, underwater springs or something like that. You know, by raising the height of the floor and just giving more space for the water to fill up in a big gravel pit, you're still going to have to pump that water out because it will deplete the foundation, the footings. The house, you know, requires a good, stable foundation, and so maybe we want to think about other ways that we could divert some of that water and deal with it. It's a tough problem. He had mentioned that there's bedrock about a foot and a half below the foundation. So the good news there is that it sounds like, you know, you're on pretty solid ground, but I think we need to find a way to divert the water. Maybe there's some landscaping that can be done towards the hill, some terracing that will help to divert a lot of the groundwater away from and around the home. It's possible that some drain tiles can be installed uphill of the home to, again, divert more water around the home. That's where I would look. The problem is water. The problem is the grade. And to the extent that landscaping can prevent water from creating problems in the basement, I think that's the best primary path.
I couldn't imagine a water, you know, just underneath. You'd think there'd be mold or other kinds of issues that would develop as well as the things that you talked about. So
You know, another thing I have to wonder, because we've been dealing with it on some of our projects, we've had some extraordinary weather the last 10 years. And what we've seen, I know from research that's been done on the lakes here and on flooding, you know, the incidence of rainfalls where we receive 3 inches or more of rain within the span of an hour or two, the number of times that's been happening in the last decade is just off the charts compared to the 50 years prior. And those events are very challenging for structures. And it could be that part of his problem is that we're living through a time of some extreme weather events. He still has to mitigate the problem and find solutions, but I can't help but wonder if maybe that isn't part of it, because a lot of people have had problems the last few years that had not existed before.
Now, if you were going to get some alternatives, or, you know, probably what he should do, and maybe he's done it already, is to get somebody in there. Who do you recommend? What kind of person would you recommend to come in and take a look at that and say, well, you know, here's an alternative for you after looking at the landscape itself?
I think that's the best question and the hardest answer, because maybe someone who puts in foundations might be able to give part of the answer, which I think is part of what we've been discussing here.
Yeah.
Possibly a landscape architect with some experience dealing with these sorts of challenges. Yeah. You know, there's some unique challenges here that require someone with a bit of experience and expertise, someone who's tried things and has learned from their successes and failures on previous projects.
So. There you have it, Randy. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Joe and Milton, will go to you next. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks. I'm calling because we've got about 110-year-old farmhouse, 3,800 square feet or so, and I think the next step we want to try to do is put some siding on it, but the only insulation we'll probably have is that styrofoam that we could put underneath the siding, and just wondering just how thick we can get away with and doing something like that.
Okay.
Well,
go ahead, Chad or Dave.
Okay, I would say I would say that a lot of times you've got two conflicting issues, because on the one hand, if you want to actually change the thermodynamics of the home in a good way and create a continuous thermal envelope. Building scientist would suggest that in this climate, you want to have 1.5 to 2 inches of continuous foam to be able to create a hyper-insulated home where you're driving the dew point to the outside. But when you do that, you have got to put up furring strips on the outside of that foam that will allow you to attach whatever the siding material is to those furring strips. And, of course, the furring strips have to be properly secured to the structure through that foam. And the good thing you get out of that is a good rain plane. Dave had referred earlier to the importance of keeping moisture out of a home. It's probably one of the most important things we have to always remember. There needs to be a way for water that gets past the siding to stay outside of the structure. And so things need to be properly flashed behind all that siding. Now, that would be kind of the higher cost, higher performance way to go. Typically, you can't go more than 1 inch of foam if you're going to just nail through the siding material through the foam. Yeah. And some sidings really have a maximum of 0.5 inch of foam. The problem with that is you don't get a high change in the dynamics of the home. You don't get tremendous payback in that extra insulation. It's worth doing. It's better. Certainly, you always want to be able to add continuous foam insulation where you can on the exterior. But that's one of the trade-offs.
Okay. Currently, the house has got studs, and then it's literally solid tongue and groove, paper, the original wood siding, another layer of paper, and then that slate siding.
I would also add to what Chad said, and that is when you're when you're thinking of taking off your siding and putting some new siding, that's an excellent opportunity to do dense packing of the walls too, because dense packing in the walls is going to really help you in terms of your air infiltration, as well as getting added insulating value. So you may want to take a look at that possibility too.
Sure. Yeah, there's always the correct way, and then there's the way you can afford.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, and I would add just one other thing, is that I would agree with Dave that the dense packing is also going to be probably one of the most cost-effective things that you're going to do within all of this, with one caveat. If there's still old knob and tube wiring in that 110-year-old farmhouse, that has got to be removed and upgraded prior to any insulating of the stud cavities.
Yeah.
So
there you have it. Thanks, Joe, for calling. Appreciate it. Charlene and Ringel, we'll turn to you next. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call today.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Well, about 2 years ago, I bought a wood stove and had it put into the house for help to heat the place, because I have an old farmhouse. And I had hydronic heat put in about 30 years ago when I bought the place. And now, since I've had the heat, the wood stove in the living room there, when I use it, my pipes freeze in the wall. My hydronic pipes freeze in the wall because the thermostat shuts off. And I was wondering if it could antifreeze in there.
Hmm. Wow.
So you've got some of your distribution of your hydronic system is in the walls.
All of it is, because they couldn't put it, they had to put it in, it's actually inside the house. It's not even, you know, between the walls. It's inside the house up against the wall. And even at that, you know, if it's really, really cold outside and I got that wood space heater going, it shuts the thermostat off and then in the downstairs and freezes the pipes along the wall.
Maybe one of the cheapest ways to handle that is to get some fans going so that you get that heat from the wood stove better distributed through the house.
Oh, yeah, it's really warm in there. I mean, it's really warm, and that's why it shuts off. But then I can't use it, you know, because if I do, my furnace will freeze up.
No.
Yeah. So.
Well, a fan would do it.
That would help. I mean, what's happening is that the heat from your wood burner isn't getting to all of the pipes that you have distributed around your home. So one of the goals might be to distribute the heat from your wood burner better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I was suggesting possibility of using some fans to help that out. I mean, if you can identify which areas get so cold that they do freeze, that's where you want the air movement to bring that warmth.
Yeah.
Another option, too, might be to just move the thermostat or look at altering the thermostat in some way. I'm not sure exactly what type of hydronic heat you have, whether or not there's a pump, whether or not...
There's a pump.
So
there's two zones and a pump.
Okay. So perhaps there's a heating contractor would be able to install something that would make it so that the pumps are operating intermittently, just so that because part of the issue too is if the water is moving in the pipes, that will help redistribute the heat that's being generated by the wood stove. Whereas if it's all just sitting there, then you're going to have less optimal distribution. And so that might be another way to kind of work around the problem, where you're not firing up the boiler, but you are moving the water, which will help prevent the freezing.
In fact, where I thought you were going to go, Chad, was moving the thermostat. They've got electronic thermostats now where you don't have to run wires to them.
Yep.
So maybe the location of your thermostat, get one of those wireless thermostats and put it in the place where the heat from the wood stove doesn't get.
Yeah. Right. We have that, and we have that in our zone heating system, and I've got that upstairs, and it's great. It's carried around the house, and it works wherever it is. There you have it, Charlene. Thank you very much for calling. And Barb in Superior, it's your turn. Hi, Barb.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
My problem is I have a half log cabin that has varnish on the outside, which is in bad shape. I'd like to remove that down to the bare wood so that I could use some of these new stains that last a lot longer than a coat of varnish. I looked into the corn cob particulate spray-on thing and pressure washing, but I think this cabin was probably built in the 1920s, and I'm a little concerned about pitting the wood. And I was just wondering what your experts felt would be the best way for me to go about removing the varnish.
I am sorry, I have to say that I would have to consult some of our painting contractors because...
it's not something you've done.
No.
Might be a forest products question, too.
Yeah. It might be another good question for Forest Products Laboratories. If you can go online to their website, you might well be able to pose that question to them either on their website or just give them a call and see what they have to say. I'm sure they'd have something to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks very much for calling. Good luck. Paul has been looking at a manufactured home. He emailed us. He says the company states that their homes are better than stick-built homes for a variety of reasons. What must one look for in a manufactured home to determine high quality?
I would want to know... In the industry, manufactured can mean many different things. What I'd want to know is if this is a what we would used to call
a modular
home or a mobile home. Mobile homes basically are made to HUD code, whereas your modular homes are made to local Wisconsin code. And there is a difference in those codes.
Mm-hmm. And the Wisconsin code's a little tougher.
It's tougher than the HUD code.
I guess it's a really tough thing. I mean, even if you're, you know, shopping for a builder or a remodeling contractor, it's really tough to, you know, be able to sort those things out because so little of the important details are ever really specified or discussed. I think that the Energy Star program is an excellent, quantifiable existing program. And I think anyone who's building or buying a new home who doesn't buy an Energy Star home is just, engaging in a foolish decision. The economic research on the payback of Energy Star standards is well established, and it'll, you know, pay back your money on average, 2 to 1 for that investment in some upgrades and higher quality and higher performance. But the only way you know about some of that is by testing. And so I'd want to know, can they deliver a manufactured Energy Star home? Because then it will be certified and tested on site. And I think that's about the only thing that I know of that really can,
But you should know that Focus on Energy and the Wisconsin Energy Star Homes program has worked with most of the modular manufacturers in Wisconsin and have developed agreements with these manufacturers so that there's in factory compliance. So they're producing Wisconsin Energy Star Homes ready modules so that it can be tested on site, but there's verification throughout the whole process. So, in fact, I have worked with basically all the manufacturers in Wisconsin so that they can go through the final testing and verification during production.
So a Wisconsin company.
There's about 10 modular manufacturers in Wisconsin that we have agreements with all of them, I'm happy to say.
Is that up online that you can see which companies are?
Yes. That should be on the FocusOnEnergy.com website under Finding a New Home. There is a list of manufacturers in Wisconsin that we have agreements with.
All right, so there you have it. Marty says he wants to replace treated wood deck. Would you recommend wood or other materials for a new deck, and what would be the cost differences?
Well, you know, there are many different options for exterior decks, and there are pros and cons to any given material. So, for example, there are a lot of synthetic, and as we were speaking earlier, vinyl siding, there are a lot of plastic deck products out there, some of them with very different composition than others, different warranties, different kind of texture and performance. The price range is significant. You know, one thing to think about, like when you're looking at any product, but particularly if you're looking at a vinyl product, if it's a dark product, it's going to get really hot if it gets direct sun exposure. And I know of people who have put in, you know, dark brown or dark red vinyl decks, and they can't stand on them. You know, they literally can't use it unless it's a cloudy day. And that doesn't seem practical. You know, I'm not sure really how to answer that question with much more specificity, but there are a lot of choices out there. You know, obviously you avoid splinters generally when you use a synthetic material, but there are a lot of wood products out there that, if properly treated and maintained, will provide, you know, years of enjoyment. And there are many issues.
If I could ask you, Chad, if you're talking about a green deck,
yeah.
What?
There are some natural woods that do not require. I'm trying to think. Cedar? Would cedar be one?
Well, cedar has a great track record, and cedar is certainly a relatively available wood. I mean, it is harvested. It used to be harvested in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. to some extent, but I mean it now we get it I think mostly from other places, you know, cedar does have some natural qualities. There are also some woods that are very popular that are coming up from South America, things like ipé and garapa gold. One hesitation I have with those is they're coming from a long way away,
yeah.
And they also are rainforest woods. And the, you know, everyone says that their lumber is sustainably harvested, but there's clear cutting still going on all over the world. And so, if that's important to you, then you know, you really have to be careful with a lot of that stuff.
After many years, and many years of staining, I got so tired of my deck that we now have a stone patio, and mm-hmm. that stone patio is great. It actually extends the size of the lawn in some ways, because it's right even with the lawn, and it's stone from local stone, and no more staining, and no more raccoons and so forth underneath the deck.
Yeah.
So,
great way to go.
There's a green solution to the deck.
That was our answer. That was our green answer to that deck. One more quick question here. When installing an engineered wood floor over concrete, is there any benefit to paint or seal the concrete floor before installing a vapor barrier?
Yes. Oh, well. I mean, need a bit more information, but if you have, say, in-floor hydronics, inch and a half of gypcrete, and you're going to want to put a wood floor over it, if you're going to want to glue that floor down, you definitely have to seal that floor. Otherwise, it's not going to get a good bind.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you have it. The time flew by, guys. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to another visit. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison. It's a full-service residential remodeling company. Take a look at his website, chadscarpentry.com, and no apostrophe there for Chad's, chadscarpentry.com. And Dave Kenyon, project manager of Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation in Madison, and their website is weccusa.org. Pleased to have these guys with us, and I know we'll be doing more programs on home renovation and repair. But tomorrow, it's Garden Talk time. Bob Tomisch, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and UW-Extension, our guest. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Net.